Kathy Frampton, said Virginia. I'm a cousin of Ellie May.
I don't think I've seen you before, said Winifred as the bus moved off.
No, I hail from Scotland, and I don't get over to the States that often.
I see you're expecting.
Yes, in a couple of months.
Are you hoping for a girl or a boy?
Virginia hadn't given a moment's thought to any questions she might be asked about being pregnant.
Whatever the good Lord decides, she said.
How very sensible, my dear.
I thought the ceremony went rather well, said Virginia, wanting to change the subject.
I agree, but I do wish Cyrus had married Ellie May 20 years ago. It was what both families had always planned.
Then why didn't he?
Cyrus was always shy. He didn't even ask Ellie May to be his date for the school prom, so he lost out to Wayne Halliday. Wayne was the school's star quarterback, and frankly, he could have had any girl he wanted, and probably did. But she let him sweep her off her feet, and let's face it, it can't have been her looks that first attracted him to Ellie May.
Where's Wayne now?
I have no idea. But with the settlement he ended up with, he's probably lounging on a South Sea island drinking pina coladas, surrounded by skimpily clad maidens.
Virginia didn't need to ask who Wayne Halliday's lawyer was. She had followed the case in the State Times with great interest, and been impressed with the size of the settlement Mr. Trend had pulled off on behalf of his client. The bus swung off the road and drove through a vast set of wrought iron gates, before proceeding down a long drive lined with tall pine trees that led to a massive colonial mansion surrounded by hundreds of acres of manicured lawns.
"What's Cyrus's ranch like?"
asked Virginia.
"About the same size, I would guess," said Winifred. "So he didn't have to bother with the prenup. A marriage made not in heaven, but on the New York Stock Exchange," she added with a smile.
The bus came to a halt outside a vast Palladian mansion. Virginia climbed off and joined the long line of guests who were having their invitations carefully checked. When she reached the front of the queue, she was handed a small white envelope by a woman who seemed to know exactly who she was.
"You're on table 6, she whispered. "No one there for you to worry about."
Virginia nodded and followed the other guests into the house. A row of white-jacketed waiters holding trays of champagne created a path all the way to the ballroom, where a lunch for 400 was waiting to be served. Virginia studied the layout of the room like a grand national jockey considering which fences might bring him down. A long table, clearly reserved for the family and their most important guests, ran down one side of the room. In front of it was a dance floor, and beyond that, 40 circular tables filled the rest of the room. Virginia was still taking all this in when a gong sounded and a toastmaster dressed in a red tailcoat announced,
"Please take your places so we can all welcome the family and their distinguished guests."
Virginia went in search of table 6, which she found on the edge of the dance floor, right in front of the top table. She introduced herself to the two middle-aged men seated on either side of her. It turned out that, like her, they were cousins, but of the Grants, not the Campbells. Buck Trend clearly wasn't taking any chances. No sooner was everyone seated than they were on their feet again to applaud the bride and groom, who were accompanied by their parents, brothers and sisters, the best man, the bridesmaids and several distinguished guests.
"That's our governor," said the man on Virginia's right, "Hayden Rankin, mighty fine fellow, much admired by the folks of Louisiana."
But Virginia was more interested in the seating at the top table. Although she had a clear view of Cyrus, she doubted he would spot her on the other side of the dance floor. How was she going to attract his attention without it being too obvious?
"I'm a cousin of Ellie May," she eventually replied as they sat back down. "And you?"
"My name's Nathan Grant. I'm a cousin of Cyrus, so I guess we're now kith and kin."
Virginia couldn't think of a suitable response.
"Is your husband with you?"
Nathan asked politely. Another question Virginia hadn't anticipated.
"No, I'm afraid he's attending a business conference he couldn't get out of, so I came with Great-Aunt Winifred instead."
She waved, and Winifred returned the compliment.
So what line of business is he in?
Virginia looked puzzled.
Your husband?
He's an insurance broker.
What's his specialty?
Horses,
Virginia said, looking out of the window.
How interesting. I'd like to meet him. Perhaps he could give me a better deal than the guy who's currently robbing me.
Virginia didn't respond, but turned to the man sitting on her left. By switching her attention from one to the other at regular intervals, she avoided having to answer too many awkward questions. She received an occasional wave from Great Aunt Winifred, but Cyrus never once glanced in her direction. How was she going to make him aware she was there? And then the question was answered for her. She was chatting to Nathan about her other child, her firstborn, giving him a name, Rufus, aged 8, and even the school he was attending, Summerfield's, when an attractive young woman from another table strolled past. Virginia noticed that several pairs of male eyes followed her progress. By the time she'd reached the other side of the dance floor, Virginia had worked out how to be sure that Cyrus couldn't miss her. However, her timing needed to be perfect, because she didn't want any rivals on the catwalk at the same time, especially one who was younger and had longer legs. After the third course had been cleared away, the toastmaster banged his gavel, and silence prevailed once again.
"Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Larry Campbell, the father of the bride."
Mr. Campbell rose from his place at the center of the top table. He began by welcoming his guests on behalf of his wife and... Virginia anticipated Mr. Campbell's speech would last for about 10 minutes. She needed to select the exact moment to make her move, because she knew she would only get one chance. While the father of the bride was welcoming Governor Rankin and the two U.S. senators was clearly not that moment. She waited until Campbell began a long anecdote about some minor incident Ellie May had been involved in when she was at school. The punchline was greeted with far more laughter and applause than it deserved, and Virginia took advantage of the pause in his speech. Rising from her place and clutching her stomach, she walked slowly around the edge of the dance floor. She gave Mr. Campbell an apologetic glance before staring, but only for a moment, directly at Cyrus. He turned chalk white, before she turned her back on him and made her way towards an exit sign on the far side of the room. The look on Cyrus's face suggested that Banquo's ghost could not have made a more effective appearance. Virginia knew her re-entry needed to be just as powerful. She waited patiently in the wings for the best man speech to finish, before the toastmaster finally called on the bridegroom, Cyrus T. Grant III, to reply on behalf of the guests. As Cyrus rose, everyone burst into applause, which was the moment Virginia chose to re-enter the arena. She moved swiftly across the dance floor and back to her seat, trying to give the impression that she didn't want to hold up the bridegroom's speech. Cyrus was not a naturally gifted speaker at the best of times, and these weren't the best of times. He stumbled through his text, repeating several lines, and when he finally sat down, he received only muted applause, along with a gracious smile from an uninvited guest. Cyrus turned round and began talking animatedly to a security guard who was stationed behind the top table. The square-shouldered giant of a man nodded and beckoned to two of his colleagues. Virginia suddenly realized she didn't have an exit strategy. When the band struck up, Nathan Grant rose gallantly from his place and was about to ask Kathy for the first dance, only to find she was already weaving her way nimbly between the tables towards the entrance. When Virginia reached the far side of the room, she glanced round to see one of the security guards pointing at her. Once she'd left the ballroom, her walk turned into a run. She shot along the corridor, out of the front door and onto the terrace at a speed no pregnant woman could possibly have managed.
"Can I help you, ma'am?"
asked an anxious-looking young man stationed at the front door.
"I think the baby's coming," said Virginia, clutching her stomach.
"Follow me, ma'am."
He ran down the steps ahead of her and quickly opened the back door of a guest limousine. Virginia climbed inside and collapsed onto the seat, just as two security guards came charging through the front door.
"Our Lady Medical Center and step on it," said the young man to the chauffeur.
As the car accelerated down the drive, Virginia turned round, and looking out of the back window, saw the two guards chasing after her. She waved at them as if she were royalty, confident that Cyrus T. Grant III knew she was in town.
"You must have made quite an impression," said Trend, even before Virginia had sat down. "Because when I called Cyrus Grant's attorney this morning, he didn't seem surprised to hear from me. We've agreed to meet at his office at 10 tomorrow."
"But I'm flying back to London this afternoon."
"Which is just dandy, because a case this important won't be settled in a hurry. Don't forget, Cyrus is on his honeymoon, and we wouldn't want to spoil that, would we? Although I have a feeling he'll be calling his lawyers from time to time."
"So what am I expected to do?"
"Go home, prepare for the birth of your child, and wait until you hear from him. And just a word of warning, Jenny. They're certain to have a detective in London keeping an eye on you."
"What makes you say that?"
"Because it's exactly what I'd do."
Virginia boarded the 4:40 p.m. flight from Baton Rouge to New York. The plane landed at Kennedy just after 10 p.m. She made her way to Gate 42 and thought she'd stop on the way to pick up a copy of Vogue. But when she saw the Barnes & Noble window was dominated by two best-selling books, she marched straight past. She didn't have long to wait before passengers were asked to board the plane for London. Virginia was met at Heathrow by a chauffeur once again supplied by Mellor Travel, who drove her down to Headley Hall in Hampshire, the country home of Boffy Bridgewater. Boffy was there to greet her as she stepped out of the car.
"Did you pull it off, my darling?" "I don't know yet, but one thing's for certain. When I return to London, I'm going to have to give birth."
Chapter 24 Buck Trend phoned Virginia the following day to tell her that two Pinkerton detectives were on their way to England to watch her every move and report back to Grant's lawyers. One mistake, he warned her, and there would be no settlement. Was there even a possibility that Trend suspected she wasn't pregnant? If Virginia was going to convince the two detectives that she was about to give birth, she would need the help of someone who was shrewd, resourceful, and unscrupulous. In short, a man who considered fooling detectives and bending the law as simply part of his everyday life. She'd only ever met one person who fitted that description, and although she despised the man, Virginia didn't have a lot of choice if the next 8 weeks were to go as planned. She knew only too well that he would expect something in return, and it wasn't money, because he already had enough for both of them. But there was one thing Desmond Mellor didn't have, and wanted desperately. Recognition. Having identified his Achilles heel, all Virginia had to do was convince him that as the daughter of the Earl of Fenwick and a distant niece of the Queen Mother, she had the key to unlock that particular door and fulfill his ambition to be tapped on the shoulder by Her Majesty and hear the words, "Arise, Sir Desmond." Operation Childbirth was run like a military campaign, and the fact that Desmond Mellor had never risen above the rank of sergeant in the pay corps and had never set eyes on the enemy made it even more remarkable. Virginia spoke to him twice a day, although they never met in person. Once he'd confirmed that the two detectives had arrived in London and were watching her apartment night and day.
"You must be sure they see exactly what they would expect to see," he told her. "Behave like any normal mother-to-be, with only a few weeks to go before she gives birth."
Virginia continued to see Boffy and his chums regularly, for lunch, even dinner, at which she munched sticks of cucumber and drank glasses of carrot juice, eschewing champagne for the first time in her life. And when pressed, she never even hinted who the father might be. The gossip column settled on Anton Deluth, the unsuitable young Frenchman who had accompanied her to Tenerife, never to be seen again. The Express kept reprinting the one blurred photograph they had of them lying on a beach together. Virginia relentlessly carried out her daily routine, with touches of sheer genius supplied by Desmond Mellor. A chauffeur-driven car picked her up once a week from Cadogan Gardens and drove her slowly to 41A Harley Street, never running a red light, never seeking a faster lane. After all, she was heavily pregnant, and, more important, she didn't want the two Pinkerton detectives to lose sight of her. On arrival at 41A, a large five-story Georgian townhouse with seven brass nameplates by its door, Virginia reported to reception for her weekly appointment with Dr. Keith Norris. Dr. Norris and his assistant then examined her for over an hour before she returned to the car and was driven home. Desmond had assured her that the doctor was completely reliable and would personally deliver the child in his private clinic.
"How much did you have to pay him to keep his mouth shut?"
"Not a penny," replied Desmond. "In fact, he only hopes that I'll keep my mouth shut." He let her wait for a moment before he added, "When Dr. Norris's attractive young nurse became pregnant, he certainly didn't want Mrs. Norris to find out why he'd chosen Mella Travel to organize her trip to a clinic in Sweden." Virginia was reminded once again that she didn't need this man as an enemy. "There are two more people who must be informed of the impending birth," said Mella, "if you want the world to believe you're pregnant."
"Who?"
asked Virginia suspiciously. "Your father and Priscilla Bingham."
"Never,"
said Virginia defiantly. Never turned out to be a week later, in the case of Priscilla Bingham. When Virginia rang her old friend in Lincolnshire, Priscilla was reserved and somewhat distant. They had parted on sour terms after Virginia had caused the breakup of her marriage, until Virginia burst into tears and said,
"I'm pregnant."
Priscilla's ex-husband, Bob Bingham, like everyone else, was curious to know who the father might be, but that was the one thing Priscilla couldn't prize out of Virginia, even during a long lunch at the Mirabelle. Virginia took a little longer to obey Desmond's second command, and even as the Flying Scotsman pulled into Edinburgh Waverley, she was still considering returning to King's Cross without leaving the train. However, she concluded she couldn't win either way. If she told her father she was pregnant, he would probably cut off her allowance. On the other hand, if Buck Trend failed to secure a settlement, and Papa were to discover she'd never been pregnant in the first place, he would undoubtedly disown her. When Virginia walked into her father's study at 10 o'clock that morning, looking 8 months pregnant, she was shocked by his reaction. The Earl assumed the Daily Express had got it right, and Anton Duluth was the father, and the cat had run off and deserted her. He immediately doubled her allowance to £4,000 a month, and only asked one thing in return, that once Virginia had given birth, she might consider visiting Fenwick Hall more often.
"A grandson, at last,"
were the words he kept repeating. For the first time, Virginia didn't curse the fact that she had three brothers who'd only sired daughters. On Priscilla's advice, Virginia placed an advertisement for a nanny in The Lady, and was surprised by how many replies she received. She was looking for someone who would take complete responsibility for the child, mother, governess, mentor, and companion, as she had no intention of fulfilling any of these obligations. Priscilla helped her prune the applicants down to a short list of six, and Desmond Mellor suggested she interview them on separate days, so the two detectives would have something new to report back to Grant's lawyers in Baton Rouge. After Virginia and Priscilla had interviewed the final five, one of them didn't turn up, they both agreed that only one of the candidates ticked all the required boxes. Mrs. Crawford was a widow and the daughter of a clergyman. Her husband, a captain in the Scots Guards, had been killed in Korea, fighting for Queen and country. Mrs. Crawford turned out to be the eldest of six children, and had spent her formative years raising the other five. Equally important, she had no children of her own. Even the Earl approved of his daughter's choice. It occurred to Virginia that if she was to play out this charade to its ultimate conclusion, she needed to look for a larger establishment that would accommodate not only a butler and housekeeper, but also the redoubtable Mrs. Crawford, along with her newborn child. After viewing several desirable residences in Kensington and Chelsea, closely observed by the two detectives, she settled on a townhouse in Onslow Gardens, that had a top floor Mrs. Crawford assured her would make a satisfactory nursery. When Virginia looked out of the drawing-room window, she noticed one of the detectives taking a photograph of the house. She smiled and told the estate agent to take the property off the market. The only slight problem Virginia now faced was that despite her father's generously increased allowance, she certainly didn't have enough money in her bank account to pay for a nanny, a butler and a housekeeper, let alone the deposit on the house in Onslow Gardens. Her former butler, Morton, had phoned earlier in the week, he was no longer allowed to visit the flat, to say that Dr. Norris had provisionally booked Mrs. Morton into the clinic in a fortnight's time. As Virginia climbed into bed that night, she decided she would have to call her lawyer in the morning. Moments after she'd fallen into a deep sleep, the phone rang. Only one person would consider calling her at that time of night, because he would still be sitting at his desk. Virginia picked up the phone and was delighted to hear the deep southern drawl on the other end of the line.
"I guess you'll be pleased to know we've finally agreed terms with Grant's lawyers," said Buck Trend. "But there are conditions."
"Conditions?"
"There always are with a settlement this large."
Virginia liked the word large.
"But we may still have a problem or two."
She didn't care so much for a problem or two.
"We've agreed on a settlement of $1 million, along with a maintenance order of $10,000 a month for the child's upbringing and education."
Virginia gasped. Not in her wildest dreams.
"How can that possibly be a problem?" she asked.
"You must agree not to reveal the identity of the father to anyone, and that means anyone."
"I'm happy to agree to that."
"You and the child will never be allowed to set foot in Louisiana. And if either of you ever decide to travel to the United States, Grant's lawyers must be informed at least a month in advance."
"I've only been to the States once in my life," said Virginia, "and I have no plans to return."
"The child's surname must be Fennec," continued Trend. "And Mr. Grant has to approve the Christian names you select."
"What's he worried about?"
"He wants to make sure that if it's a boy, you don't call him Cyrus T. Grant IV.
Virginia laughed.
"I've already selected the name if it's a boy."
"And if any of these conditions are broken at any time, all payments will immediately cease."
"That's quite an incentive to keep to the agreement," said Virginia.
"All payments will automatically cease in 1995, by which date it is assumed the child will have completed his or her full-time education."
"I'll be nearly 70 by then."
"And finally, Mr. Grant's attorneys will be sending a doctor and a nurse to England to witness the birth."
Virginia was glad Trend couldn't see her face. Once she put the phone down, she immediately rang Desmond Mellor to ask him how they could possibly get round that seemingly intractable problem. When the phone rang again at 7:45 the following morning, Desmond had come up with a solution.
"But won't Dr. Norris object?"
asked Virginia.
"Not while there's a chance he might have to explain to his wife and children why he's been struck off the medical register."
Virginia waited until she heard the siren before she called her lawyer in Baton Rouge.
"The baby's going to be born prematurely," she screamed down the phone. "I'm on my way to the hospital now."
"I'll inform Grant's attorneys immediately."
A few minutes later, there was a loud knock on the door. When the butler answered it, one of the paramedics picked up Virginia's overnight case, while the other took her gently by the arm and guided her to a waiting ambulance. She glanced across the road to see two men clambering into a car. When the ambulance arrived at 41A Harley Street, the two paramedics opened the back door and led their patient slowly into the private clinic to find Dr. Norris and a staff nurse waiting for them. Norris left instructions that he should be told immediately the American doctor and his assistant arrived. He only needed 15 minutes. Nobody took any notice of the couple who slipped out of the back door of the clinic and took a taxi for the first time in their lives. But then it wasn't every day the Mortons were handed £1,000 in cash. Virginia undressed quickly and put on a nightgown. After she had climbed into the bed, the nurse dabbed some rouge on her cheeks and sprayed a little moisture on her forehead. She lay back, trying to look exhausted. 22 minutes later, The nurse rushed back in.
Dr. Langley and his assistant had just arrived and are asking if they can witness the birth.
Too late, said Dr. Norris, who left the patient to welcome his American colleagues. We heard it was an emergency, Dr. Langley said. Is the baby all right?
I can't be sure yet, said Norris, looking concerned. I had to perform an emergency cesarean. The baby is in an incubator, and I've given Lady Virginia a sedative to help her sleep.
Dr. Norris led them through to a room where they could observe the newborn infant in the incubator seemingly fighting for its life. A narrow plastic tube inserted into one nostril was connected to a ventilator, and only the steady beeps of the heart monitor showed the child was actually alive.
I'm feeding the little fellow through a gastric tube. We just have to pray his fragile body will accept it.
Dr. Langley examined the child closely for some time before asking if he could see the mother.
Yes, of course, said Norris.
He led the two Americans through to the private room where Virginia was lying in bed, wide awake. Immediately the door opened, she closed her eyes, lay still, and tried to breathe evenly.
I'm afraid it's been rather an ordeal for the poor lady, but I'm confident she'll recover quickly. I wish I could say the same for her child.
Virginia was relieved they only stayed for a few minutes, and she didn't open her eyes until she heard the door close behind them.
If you'd like to remain overnight, we have a guest room, but if you return first thing in the morning, I'll be able to give you my written report.
The Americans took one more look at the baby before leaving. Later that evening, Dr. Langley reported back to Grant's lawyers that he doubted the child would make it through the night. But then he had no way of knowing that the baby had never needed to be in intensive care in the first place. Dr. Langley and his assistant returned to 41A Harley Street the following morning, when Norris was able to report a slight improvement in the child's condition. His mother was sitting up in bed, enjoying her breakfast. She looked suitably anguished and pale when they visited her. Other visitors dropped in during the week, including Virginia's father and her three brothers, as well as Boffy Bridgewater, Desmond Mellor, and Priscilla Bingham, who were all delighted by the child's progress. Virginia was surprised how many people said,
"He's got your eyes."
"And your ears," Boffy added.
"And the ancestral fennec nose," pronounced the Earl.
On the seventh day, mother and child were allowed to go home, where the responsibility for the infant was taken over by Nanny Crawford. However, Virginia had to wait another 3 weeks before she could begin to relax. And that was only after she had been told, courtesy of Mellor Travel, that Dr. Langley and his assistant had boarded a plane for New York, accompanied by one of the detectives.
"Why hasn't the other one gone back with them?"
she asked Mellor.
"I don't know yet, but I'll find out."
A wire transfer for $750,000 arrived at Coutts 3 days later and was credited to the account of Lady Virginia Fenwick. Mr. Fairbrother rang and asked if her ladyship wanted the dollars converted into pounds.
"What's the spot rate as we speak?"
Virginia asked.
$2.63 to the pound, my lady," said a surprised Fairbrother. "So what amounting in sterling will be credited to my account?"
£285,171, my lady."
"Then go ahead, Mr. Fairbrother, and send me confirmation the moment you've completed the transaction,"
she added, before putting the phone down. Desmond Mellor smiled.
"We're perfect."
Virginia and a healthy little boy moved into number 9 Onslow Gardens 16 days later, along with Nanny Crawford, the butler, and a housekeeper. Virginia inspected the nursery briefly, and then handed the child over to its willing new devotee, before disappearing downstairs. The christening was held at St. Peter's, Eaton Square, and was attended by the Earl of Fenwick, who made one of his rare visits to London, Priscilla Bingham, who had reluctantly agreed to be a godmother, and Boffy Bridgewater, who was delighted to be a godfather. Desmond Mellor kept a wary eye on a solitary figure seated at the back of the church. The vicar held the baby over the font and dipped a finger in the holy water before making a sign of the cross on the child's forehead.
"Christ claims you for his own. Frederick Archibald Ian Bruce Fenwick, receive the sign of his cross,"
The Earl beamed. Amela looked around to see the lone detective had disappeared. He had honored his part of the bargain, and now he expected Virginia to keep hers. Maisie Clifton, 1972. Chapter 25. William Warwick was just about to arrest the wrong person when there was a gentle tap on the door. The rule was sacrosanct in the Clifton household. It had to be a serious matter, a very serious matter, before any member of the family would consider interrupting Harry while he was writing. In fact, he could recall the three occasions it had occurred during the past 25 years. The first had been when his beloved daughter Jessica had won a scholarship to the Slade School of Fine Art in Bloomsbury. She had burst into the room without knocking, waving the letter of acceptance, and Harry had dropped his pen and opened a bottle of champagne to celebrate. The second was when Emma had won the casting vote over Major Alex Fisher to become chairman of Barrington Shipping, and the first woman to chair a public company. Another bottle of champagne. And the third he still considered to be marginal. Giles had barged in to announce that he'd been offered a peerage by Harold Wilson and would be taking the title Lord Barrington of Bristol Docklands. Harry put his pen down on his desk and swiveled his chair round to face the intruder. Emma walked in, her head bowed, tears streaming unchecked down her cheeks. Harry didn't need to be told that his mother was dead. Harry spent more hours working on the eulogy for his mother's funeral than he had on any lecture, address, or speech he'd ever delivered in the past. His final draft, the 14th, in which he felt he'd captured her indomitable spirit, ran for 12 minutes. He visited St. Luke's the morning before the service, so he could see where he would be sitting and how far it was from the pulpit. He then tested the acoustics to find out how well his voice carried. The Dean of St. Luke's pointed out that if there was a large congregation, his words might be a little muffled. A useful warning, thought Harry, because the church turned out to be so packed that if the family hadn't reserved seats, they would have had to stand at the back. The order of service had been chosen in advance by Maisie, so no one was surprised that it was traditionally English and very Maisie. Rock of Ages, Abide with Me, To Be a Pilgrim, and, of course, Jerusalem, ensured that the congregation sang with heart and voice. Sebastian had been selected to read the first lesson. During the last verse of Abide with Me, he walked slowly up to the lectern, no longer trying to disguise a slight limp that had taken longer to recover from than the Indian surgeon had predicted. No one could predict how long it would take to recover from the last funeral he'd attended. He began to read 1 Corinthians. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but have not charity. And Giles delivered the second reading, a poem by Kipling, If You Can Keep Your Head When All About You, while the choir sang, O Rejoice That the Lord Has Risen. By the time Harry rose from his place in the front row and made his way to the pulpit during the last verse of To Be a Pilgrim, there was a sense of anticipation as he climbed the pulpit steps. He placed his text on the small brass lectern and checked the opening sentence, though in truth he knew the whole script by heart. He looked up, and once the congregation had settled, he began.
How proud my mother would have been to see so many of you here today, some who have travelled from far and wide to celebrate her amazing life. You just can't fill the churches nowadays, she used to say. Can't understand it myself, because when I was a child, the sermons went on for over an hour. Dear Mother, Harry said, looking up the ceiling, I promise mine won't be over an hour, and by the way, the church is packed.
A ripple of laughter broke out, allowing Harry to relax a little.
Maisie was born in 1901, in the reign of Queen Victoria, and died at the age of 71. During the reign of Queen Elizabeth II. My bookends is how she used to describe the two queens. She began life at 27 Stillhouse Lane, in the back streets of the Bristol Docks, and my father, Arthur Clifton, a docker, who was born in 1898, lived at number 37.
They didn't even have to cross the road to bump into each other. My father died when I was only one, so I never knew him, and the responsibility for bringing me up fell squarely on the shoulders of my mother. Maisie was never ambitious for herself, but that didn't stop her spending those early years scrimping and saving farthings, yes, farthings, to ensure that I was never hungry and never went without. Of course, I had no idea of the sacrifices she had to endure to make it possible for me to attend St. Bede's as a choral scholar, and later to go on to Bristol Grammar School before being offered a place at Oxford, a city she visited only once. If Maisie had been born today, it would have been a city that would have welcomed her with open arms. How can I be so sure of that? Because at the age of 62, where most people are preparing for retirement, Maisie enrolled at Bristol University, and 3 years later graduated with a first-class honours degree. She remains to this day the only member of the Clifton family to have managed that distinction. Imagine what she might have achieved if she had been born a generation later. My mother was a regular churchgoer until the day she died, and I once asked her if she thought she'd go to heaven. "I certainly hope so," she told me, "as I need to have a word with St. Peter, St. Paul, and our Lord." You will not be surprised to hear that I asked her what she intended to say to them. "I shall point out to St. Peter that none of the women who were close to our Lord ever denied him, let alone three times. Typical man." This time the laughter was sustained. Harry, now feeling in control of his audience, didn't continue until he had complete silence. "And when it comes to St. Paul," Maisie said, "I shall ask him why it took him so long to get the message." "And our Lord?" I asked her. "If you are the Son of God, could you please point out to the Almighty that the world would be a far better place if there had only been one religion? Because then we could have all sung from the same hymn sheet." Harry had never experienced applause in a church before, and he knew it would have delighted his mother. When someone close to you dies, you remember all the things you wish you'd said, and it's suddenly too late to say. I wish I'd understood, appreciated, and been fully aware of the sacrifices my mother made, which have allowed me to live such a privileged life, a life I fear I sometimes take for granted. When I first went to St. Bede's, dressed in my smart navy blazer and long grey trousers, we took the tram from Chapel Street, and I never understood why we got off a few hundred yards from the school. It was because my mother didn't want the other boys to see her. She thought I would be ashamed of her. "I am ashamed," said Harry, his voice cracking. "I should have paraded this great lady, not hidden her. And when I went to Bristol Grammar School, she continued to work full-time as a waitress at the Royal Hotel during the day and as a hostess at Eddie's Club every evening. I didn't realize it was because that was the only way she could afford the school fees. But, like St. Peter, whenever any of my school chums asked if it was true that my mother worked in a nightclub, I denied her." Harry's head dropped, and Emma looked on anxiously as the tears ran down his cheeks. What hardships did she have to endure without ever once, burdening me with her problems? And now it's too late to let her know. Harry's head dropped again. "To tell her," he said, desperately searching for his place. He gripped the side of the pulpit. And when I went to Bristol Grammar School, I didn't realize..." He furiously turned back a page. "I never realized..." He turned another page. "Whenever one of my school chums asked me..." Giles rose slowly from his place in the front row, walked across to the pulpit and climbed the steps. He placed an arm around his friend's shoulder and guided him back to his place in the front pew. Harry took Emma's hand and whispered, "I let her down, when she most needed me.
Giles didn't whisper when he replied, "No son has ever paid his mother a greater compliment. And right now she's telling St. Peter, 'That's my boy Harry down there.'" After the service, Harry and Emma stood by the door of the church, shaking hands with a long line of well-wishers. Harry had still not fully recovered, but it quickly became clear that the congregation universally agreed with Giles's sentiments. Family and friends returned to the manor house and raised glasses as they swapped stories about a remarkable woman who touched the lives of everyone with whom she came into contact. Finally, when the last guest had departed, Harry, Emma, and Sebastian were left alone.
"Let's drink to my mother's memory," said Harry. "I think it's time to open the 57 Merlot that Harold Ginsburg said should be saved for a special occasion. But before we do," he added as he uncorked the bottle, "I have to tell you that my mother gave me a letter a few weeks ago that she said was not to be opened until after her funeral."
He removed an envelope from his inside pocket with a flourish, tore it open and pulled out several handwritten pages in Maisie's bold, unmistakable script. Emma sat down, feeling a little apprehensive, while Seb perched on the edge of his seat, as if he were back at school, before Harry began to read.
"Dearest Harry, these are no more than a few rambling thoughts from an old woman who should know better, so you are most welcome to dismiss them as such. Let me begin with my dear grandson, young Sebastian. I still think of him as young, despite all that he's achieved in such a short period of time. Achievements that have been earned by ability combined with prodigious hard work, and I am sure he will realize his aim of becoming a millionaire by the age of 40. Commendable, no doubt, but, Sebastian, by the time you reach my age, you will have learned that acquiring great wealth is unimportant if you have no one to share it with. Samantha was among the kindest, most generous people I have ever known, and you were foolish to part with such a gem. If that was not enough, it has been a great sadness to me that I never met my great-granddaughter, Jessica, because if she was anything like your sister, I know I would have adored her."
"How could she possibly have known about Jessica?" said Seb.
"I told her," admitted Harry. "I would also like to have known Priya, who by all accounts was a very special young woman, who loved you so dearly she was willing to sacrifice her life for you. And what a compliment to your parents that the color of her skin never crossed your mind because you were in love with her. So her race and religion were irrelevant, which would not have been possible for someone of my generation. You lost Priya because of her parents' prejudice. Make sure you don't lose Sam and Jessica, because you are too proud to make the first move."
Sebastian bowed his head. He knew she was right.
"And now to you, dear Emma. Frankly, people should never listen to their mothers-in-law. Behind every successful man, they say, is a surprised mother-in-law. Harry owes so much of his success to your loving support as both a wife and mother. But, and you knew there would be a but, you have, in my opinion, by no means achieved your potential. Proust said, 'We all end up doing the thing we're second best at.' There is no doubt that you have been an outstanding chairman of Barrington Shipping, as your directors, shareholders, and the City of London readily acknowledge. But that should not be enough for someone with your remarkable talents. No, I believe the time has come for you to use some of your vision and energy for the public good. There are so many causes that could flourish under your leadership. Simply giving money to charity is the easy way out. Giving time is much more precious. So make it your aim that when you die, people will not remember you only as the chairman of Barrington's."
"Why didn't she tell me that when she was alive?"
said Emma.
"Perhaps she thought you were too busy to listen, my darling. I can't wait to hear what she has to say to you, Dad. And finally, my beloved son, Harry. For a mother to say that she is proud of her son is only human.
However, I could never have dreamed of the happiness your success, both as a novelist and as a campaigner for those who don't know freedom, would bring me. Although I believe, as I know you do, that your courageous fight for Anatoly Babakov is your finest achievement, I know you will not be satisfied until he is a free man and can join his wife in America. Have you ever told Emma you turned down a knighthood, an honor you would not consider accepting while Babakov was still in prison? I am proud of you for that, even though I would have enjoyed hearing my son addressed as Sir Harry.
You never told me, said Emma.
I never told anyone, said Harry. Giles must have somehow found out.
He returned to the letter.
And now to William Warwick, who has entertained so many people for so many years. Harry, perhaps it's time for him to retire, so that you can finally stretch yourself to reach even greater heights. You told me once, many years ago, the rough outline of a novel you had always wanted to write, but had never got round to. Never got round to it because Harold Ginsberg, that wicked old publisher, kept tempting you with bigger and bigger advances. Perhaps the time has now come for you to write a book that will bring happiness for generations to come, whose reputation will outlive any bestseller list and make it possible for you to join that handful of authors whose names will never die. Rant over. All that is left for me to say is thank you for making my final years so peaceful, comfortable, and enjoyable. And when the time comes for any of you to write a similar letter, please don't be like me and feel you could have done so much more with your life. Your loving mother, Maisie.
Harry poured 3 glasses of the 57 Merlot and handed one each to Emma and Seb. He raised his own glass and said,
"To Maisie. Shrewd old thing."
"To Maisie," repeated Emma and Seb, raising their glasses.
"Ah, and I nearly forgot," said Harry, picking the letter back up. "There's a postscript. P.S. Please remember me to your dear friend Giles, who can consider himself lucky that I didn't write about him, because had I done so, it would have been a far longer letter."
Chapter 26.
"Good morning, Mrs. Clifton. My name is Eddie Lister. We met briefly at your mother-in-law's funeral, but there's no reason you should remember me." "How did you know Maisie, Mr. Lister?"
Emma asked. Because he was right, she couldn't place him.
"I'm chairman of the governors of the Bristol Royal Infirmary. She was one of our volunteers and will be sadly missed by patients and staff alike." "I had no idea," said Emma. "What did she do?" "She was in charge of the lending library and organized the daily rota for the book trolley to be taken around the wards. More people read books at BRI than in almost any other hospital in the country." "Why am I not surprised?" said Emma. "Are you looking for someone to replace her? Because if you are, I'd certainly be happy to do so." No, thank you, Mrs. Clifton. That isn't the reason I'm calling. But I'm confident I could organize the library, and what's more, my family has had a close association with the hospital for many years. My grandfather, Sir Walter Barrington, was chairman of the governors. My husband was nurse back to health at BRI after being seriously wounded by a German landmine in 1945. And my mother spent the last months of her life there under the care of Dr. Rayburn. What's more, I was born at the Royal Infirmary. I'm impressed, Mrs. Clifton, but I still don't think you're the right person to organize the book trolley. May I ask why you won't even consider me? Because I was rather hoping you'd agree to become a governor of the hospital."
Emma was momentarily silenced.
"I'm not altogether sure I know what a hospital governor does. Every major NHS hospital, and ours is one of the largest in the country, has a board of governors drawn from the local community. And what would my responsibilities be?" "We hold a meeting every quarter, and I also invite each trustee to take an interest in one particular department of the hospital. I thought nursing might appeal to you. Our senior matron, Mima Puddicum, represents the 2,000 nurses who work full or part-time at BRI. I should mention that if you agree to become a governor, there is no remuneration or expenses. I realize you are a busy woman, Mrs. Clifton, with many responsibilities, but I do hope you'll give some thought to my proposal before you make... I've thought about it. Mr. Lister sighed. Yes, I feared you'd be too busy with all your other commitments. And, of course, I thoroughly understand. I'd be delighted to become a governor of the hospital, Mr. Chairman. When do I start?
Marshal Koschevoy is becoming somewhat restless, Comrade Brandt. He thinks it's time you came up with something a little more tangible. After all, you've been living with Barrington for the past year, and all you've produced so far is the minutes of the Labour Party's weekly meetings in the House of Lords. Hardly illuminating.
I have to be careful, Comrade Director, said Karen, as they walked arm in arm down a quiet country lane. If Barrington were to become suspicious and my cover was blown, all our painstaking preparations would have been for nothing. And while he's in opposition and not a member of the government, he isn't privy to what's going on in Whitehall. But if the Labour Party wins the next election, and Barrington is confident they will, that could all change overnight. And if I recall your exact words when I took on this assignment, we are not in a hurry. We're in this for the long game.
That is still the case, comrade. However, I'm becoming concerned that you might be enjoying your bourgeois existence as Barrington's mistress a little too much, and have forgotten where your true allegiance lies.
I joined the party when I was still at school, Comrade Director, and have always been dedicated to our cause. You have no reason to question my loyalty. Tap, tap, tap.
They fell silent when they saw an elderly gentleman approaching.
Good afternoon, Colonel, said Pengelly.
Afternoon, John. How nice to see your daughter again, said the old man, raising his hat.
Thank you, Colonel, said Pengelly. She's just down for the day, and we thought a breath of country air wouldn't do us any harm.
Capital, said the Colonel. I really miss my constitutional. Gets me out of the house. Well, must be getting along, or the mem sahib will be wondering where I am.
Of course, sir.
Pengelly didn't speak again until they could no longer hear the tap-tap-tap of the Colonel's walking stick.
"Has Barrington asked you to marry him?" he asked, taking Karen by surprise.
"No, Comrade Director, he has not. After two failed marriages, I don't think he'll be rushing into a third.
Perhaps if you were to become pregnant," he said, as they turned off the road and followed a path that led to a disused tin mine.
"What use would I be to the party then? If I had to spend all my time bringing up a child. I'm a trained operative, not a babysitter.
Then let's see some proof of it, Comrade Brandt. Because I can't go on telling my masters in Moscow tomorrow, 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 like a parrot.
Barrington is attending an important meeting in Brussels next Monday, when he'll witness the signing of the treaty that will make Britain a member of the EEC. He's asked me to accompany him. I may be able to pick up some useful information, as there will be a lot of foreign delegates around.
Good. With so many ambitious politicians all trying to prove how important they are, be sure to keep your ears open, especially at dinners and casual get-togethers. They have no idea how many languages you speak, and don't switch off in the evening when they'll be relaxed after a drink or two and more likely to say something they might later regret, especially to a beautiful woman.
Karen looked at her watch.
We'd better turn back. I'm supposed to be in Bristol in time for dinner with Giles and his family.
Won't want you to miss that, said Pengelly, as they began to retrace their steps. And do remember to wish Giles a happy Christmas.
On the journey back from Truro to Bristol, Karen couldn't stop thinking about the dilemma she now faced. During the past year, she had fallen deeply in love with Giles, and had never been happier in her life. But she'd become trapped, playing a role she no longer believed in, and she couldn't see a way out of the maze. If she suddenly stopped supplying information for the Stasi, her masters would call her back to Berlin, or worse. If she lost Giles, she would have nothing to live for. By the time she drove through the gates of the manor house, the dilemma hadn't been resolved, and wouldn't be, unless... "Is Karen joining us for dinner?" asked Emma as she poured her brother a whiskey.
"Yes, she's driving up from Cornwall. She's been to visit her father, so she may be a little late."
"She's so bright and full of life," said Emma. "I can't imagine what she sees in you."
"I agree. And it's not as if she doesn't know how I feel about her, because I've asked her to marry me enough times."
"Why do you think she keeps turning you down?" asked Harry.
"With my track record, who can blame her? But I think she may be weakening." "That's good news, and I'm so pleased you'll both be joining us for Christmas."
"And how are you?"